T-shirt raise on board is 1:35 p.m. And it is the 7th of March. We do have four members here. The Board of Quebec Business Consultants and myself, Senator John Conville, the Vice Chair, Senator Peter Ritchie, and Senator Mia Costello. We have four items on the agenda today. The first is Senate Bill 180, which is a bill regarding the power of attorney related to parent and guardian of a child. We pass this bill out in a prior hearing, and we're going to go ahead and rescind our action and adopt a new version, backslash PEPA, to hear what the conceptual changes were from drafting. So I'd appreciate your motion, Senator Conville.
I'd like to rescind the 180 and
is there an objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, the drafting on version H, Senate Bill 180 has been rescinded.
That brings us back to version H at this point.
So version P, we get a motion from that.
And there, I move that place that we adopt the CSU Senate Bill number 180, version P, and 3416, and that the Cardi Armour from the Senate is the office of Energy and Changes.
Excellent. Senator Ritchie.
We're going to act for reasons of explanations.
Excellent. So, according to the simple record, and then do note that the TRB Lister is available for a phone call and directing if members need further clarification. Thank you. So, for everybody, it's Cardi Armour, staff to Senator Diesel. Last week, when we heard that H was a hotel of this bill, there were some conceptual amendments made by committee members. And when we were getting the final version of that CS drafting, it was brought to our attention by legal services that there was a pretty significant drafting error that wasn't caught in any prior case. And that drafting error serves on page 6 of the P version of the bill in section 3. And there was getting the references to sections, to the section that was created as 13.6023. And there was an amendment to that section that was missing from the bill, which is why there's a new section. I tried to understand its place in it because it was a bit of a complex issue involving the interstate compact that I don't completely understand, but wanted to correct to make sure that the citation is brought back to the correct statute now.
Excellent.
Okay, thank you. Is Terry in the room or in the line? Okay, questions from the members for Terry? Okay, so can you do a little bit better job of explaining your dear best to capture the serious difference between this is the vote pertaining to parents' inability to delegate away a power of attorney in absence of the other parent's consent and approval, so long as their parent wanted that be terminated. Correct. So, Madam Chair, going off for the record, but the value error in this bill has nothing to do with the actual content and intent of the bill. It has to do with references. So, in section 1 of the section 2 of the bill, we create this new subsection of delegation of powers over a minor child. It is 13.6.023, which means it's split from the previous section, which was AS 13.6.020. So we were updating all of the references that statute made, and there were some missing. So the references were missing, which is why they needed to add in this section, this new section, which is a section 4 on page 6 of the P version, and the new section of the bill to continue to update all of the references that were made to AS 13.6.020. There's a main effective date because it deals with an interstate compact. There was an amendment made to that compact in 2008 with the going effective date, which is why on page 8 of the bill, section 8, there is a going effective date clause as well.
I just want to make sure that the delayed effective date is in the new P version.
Right.
I just want to make sure because it's not in the H version. And indirectly to
Section 3 isn't changed. Section 4 is a new addition that refers to the amendment that was missed that was made reference to in Section 3. So when you look at the statute under AS 2523.060, Section C, there is an amendment that wasn't captured when the first draft of the bill was originally introduced. Any questions for the representative of the bill sponsor? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I'm going to take a motion. The objection has been removed. Now I'm taking a motion.
Smoking has is under the Commerce Clause as opposed to the First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court of Alaska and the United States have upheld reasonable restrictions in this area for 19 and older and allowed that year threshold, if you will, because of the Commerce Clause issues of the First Amendment right to both drinking alcohol and tobacco.
Cigarettes and most commonly referred to as quote-unquote vaping.
So they just had all their, you know, entire subculture exists around this activity. This is the introduction of 2007 in the United States. There's now hundreds of known products, products, monkey products, available in a wide range of styles, designs, potencies, and flavors. Because this industry is relatively new and developing so rapidly, there's little to no conclusive evidence as to the long term effect on our health. Now, you want to hear that? Part of this, of course, is built. Everyone wants to keep these products out of their hands as long as it gets in their hands, really. So it's not much of a stretch to say that this product is able to be bigger for young people. It's likely to have just a mixture of some kind, at least a number of flavors of all new generations of food stores. You also want to hear that these products are immensely helpful for people trying to quit smoking, which may, in some cases, be true, but most typically, not if at all, it only works for adult smokers. You may also hear that this product is about personal freedoms. There are many personal freedoms that occur in relation to our teenagers, so for our teenagers, including voting, driving, alcohol consumption, concerts, R-rated venues, banking, health camps, etc., etc. All of that merit, but the question here is, should possessing and consuming these electronic smoking products be under one of those limitations? You're also going to hear that vaping or e-cigarettes are way better than tobacco, that they're perfectly safe for animals. It might be true, but we don't really know that yet. Research results vary, seeing that according to the base of that research, but no one can reliably argue on either side of this table as to whether these products are truly safe. Meanwhile, I would assert that it shouldn't take a scientific study to imagine that they are any chemical. Besides that, of course, regulated ones is to produce a higher sensation than any of those things that is good for your body, or you don't know, for your body. And finally, you're going to hear that these are not tobacco products, which is maybe the last thing here, and should not be associated with tobacco, which is agreeable to an extent. It's important to say that vaping and e-cigarettes are not tobacco products in and of themselves. However, if we looked at tobacco and the act of smoking, and we hold these two activities up together, side by side, and we ask some questions. Is the analogy that you purposely hold your mouth? Does it produce or emit a chemical that you inhale? Does that chemical that you inhale produce an effect on the human body or mind? And if the elephant in the room here is, does that component contain nicotine? So, what those questions might ask you is smoking a cigarette and smoking from flavor devices, in whatever shape or amount of flavor or whether they're in the future, are they really that different from one another? So, this bill overall is about long-term health. It's about changing healthy lifestyles. We propose restricting the access to electronic smoking products in the same manner as we've restricted access to tobacco products. And as this government, of course, are not interested in excessive government regulation. However, the policy question before you is, if you consider our current laws and regulations on traditional smoking and nicotine products as being fair and reasonable in terms of their possession and consumption by your youth, is it also fair and reasonable to apply similar laws when rights to this new technology, smoking cigarettes, vaping, e-juice, tobacco alternatives, whatever you want to call them, here today we're referring to as electronic smoking products or different measures that are ESPs because they're not going to be read. We propose to hold the industry and consumers accountable for someone possessing these products in order to protect our young people. And with that, I will be able to answer your questions.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Merkin. And just a couple questions to reiterate on the record. Nothing in this bill is meant to apply to adults in Alaska 19 years of age, 20 years of age older.
That's correct.
Okay. And the other question I have on the record is, if under any exceptions to this statement, that in all places where we have penalties associated with underage tobacco use or selling, we simply added electronic smoking product. Are there any exceptions? Is there any part of the bill that creates a new series of violations or sanctions that are equally and uniquely related to the electronic smoking product?
No. However, if I could add, there is a policy question that I would ask for you to consider that we overlooked in the entire committee, and that is currently the way it's structured is not explicit, but if Xander sells the tobacco endorsement and allows them to sell e-cigarettes and tobacco both, but if they violate the e-cigarette component, currently, they only suspend their sales activity for those who say they're close. You know, they could go ahead and keep selling tobacco. So the question is, should we add efforts to these e-cigarette statutes to also include that they can't sell the tobacco products either? Did I help you to
thanks for bringing it out. It's an interesting question. And then, absolutely, has there been reason to wonder in the cases where a vendor also sells alcohol, for example, and there is an alcohol violation, would they then be prohibited from selling tobacco, and how the department sees that? So maybe that's an interesting question for the Department of Commerce. If you have, I guess, because you have multiple items that you're selling that are restricted, how do you cross over?
I would show you that's not the intent of the bill. Okay. There could be circumstances there that affect.
Okay.
So,
Chicky.
I have questions about the bill, but if we're going to include a section, or can we come up with an exception?
Okay. Members will need to wait for the exception. Yes. The voice of folks online, as well as the literature of the section, I'll just tell members where the resources that might be available. A lot of this is going to be public testimony of business owners, individuals coming out of also that ignorance and fair rates. However, we do also have Jim Darnell, who's at the Department of Behavioral Health and Tobacco Enforcement in the state of Alaska. We have the Commission of Public Health and Andrea Fignati. And let's see here, we also do have them in the room, Jimmy Hovenden with DCD. From the commerce section as well is our resource. Mr. Lincoln?
For the section?
Yes, please.
So, section one has an existing law that was prohibiting minors from possessing cigarettes of tobacco to also prohibit possession of electronic cigarettes and the component thereof. Section two would and to the law as well as vending machines, and that vending machines dispensing electronic cigarettes on the products must also be supervised. Section 3 will have to the same law that minor may not sell tobacco or nicotine products, nor may they sell electronic cigarettes or any related component thereof.
Senator Borjanski.
Mr. Chair, question number one. If someone shut down this one, the cigarettes started to. My understanding is that nicotine was banned, the sale of nicotine was not banned for trading. Does this ban the selling of non-nicotine e-cigarette formulas to children?
This is a common definition of this year. As a common definition later on, that is the intent, is that we want to cover not just the actual juice cartridge, but also any component thereof of the excellent. Section 4 provides an exception for persons missing if they're a minor and have an approved medical purpose to possess or consume these electronics, that there are legitimate reasons and circumstances that they may use them. Section 5 has any question for
Senator
Dean. I'm not sure I understand section 4 completely. Provisions of the decision to not buy, sell, exchange, or gift from a person under 19 years of age of an electronic smoking product that is supposed to be legal for a parent the legal guardian to give someone 20 years of age or younger electronic cigarette to the general family to do it. It's my understanding that if there is a parental involvement, that they do have, under certain circumstances, within the most provided hour, depending on this product, almost typically the intention or at least is that it be for a prescribed medical purpose. It is one, two, or three, or four, just like the old section did for those containing nicotine. Just there's if you don't have anything to the judiciary committee, this particular section was not originally how we asked it to be crafted, but this is how legal set it up. It was legal drafting mechanism that they use. And I have to refer to legal to get into that nuance as to editing as it was laid out that way. But in any event, the intent of that section is to allow for the limited medical service taxes to allow use to access these products.
I don't see there's a burden of rules. If we could just follow up on that, Mr. Lincoln, with Senator Richard Davey, to be clear that the intent is to allow for parents to provide nicotine in the place where there's a medical need, et cetera.
As a new subsection is consistent with existing law regarding placement of vending machines, where they're situated in the business and so forth. This like as if they were dispensing tobacco products, the same requirements would be applied if they were dispensing e-cigarettes. But I'm pointing you for the record that as environments are somehow aware of any existing vending machines, this is sort of a preemptive section. Section 6 here is our definition, which is the cornerstone of the legislation. We surely struggle with this to other states in trying to avoid any potential loophole that could be exploited. In summary, this device, electronic smoking product, or ESP, is designed as again, as a summary, I think, after you've heard the bill itself, which is not badly done. But the device is designed to consumer is aerosolized and inhale nicotine. A synthetic of nicotine, or any other potentially hazardous substance that may, quote, have an adverse effect on the person inhaling it. And the adverse effect component is language that was obtained from the FDA. Section 7 is another result conforming units that are looking for. Just a little clear, maybe if this applies to those little bottles that don't include nicotine. Okay, the child uses cigarettes without the alcohol. The key there would be is, will they have an adverse effect on their health? That would be the question. And to this point, we don't know exactly. There's just not enough information or data out there.
So they would be able to.
Okay, well, then you didn't understand the question. So
would someone who would be able to use an e-cigarette that does not contain
arguably, you will hear that there are supposedly products out there that do not contain nicotine, but there is no proof of that yet. This is only one of the comments.
I got poor in the cigar shop. I found some legislation to use 20 milliliter bottles and said that 50 strands of nicotine as it go all the way down to zero nicotine. And it's just a question I have a concern about that is would this be it's using the e-cigarettes that don't contain nicotine? Because they use all of them nicotine. So just you look at that and very careful if you're using it.
It seems like in section 6, covers those products that don't contain nicotine. That is, just about to refer to that for definition. Thank you for my assistance.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to, that line 14 through 16, the kids are that you're trying to get that non-nicotine substance there is, or any substance that may cause an adverse effect on the person inhaling from the device. And that you really have to come at it, right? Because if you try to come at it from the device delivery itself, you'd be able to probably, I think, more First Amendment issues than nicotine, cigarettes, and those types of things. So you have to go through the health, the potential health issue itself for the regulation. But I think that that's what you're referring to, aren't you?
Okay, we're on section 7. It is like drafting, defining, changing, because we're not talking about just tobacco product endorsements, it's the change to business license endorsement. So if you do sell tobacco or electronic smoking product, we would still need that same endorsement. So it's a conforming section. And it also sets it up for the remaining sections here. Section 8, existing law. Requiring a special business license endorsement in order to lawfully sell these products.
Is that really not what the statute says here? Is it really not required?
Section 7 that it's 441 or change of tobacco to business license is held. That's the question of that. Okay, again, because we're first of all, we're not defining ESP as tobacco product. And so we want the vendors selling ESPs to have an endorsement. That's kind of the cornerstone or part of the key components of the bill for enforcement purposes. To put an umbrella over both people selling tobacco products and these ESPs.
Okay, and then on that point,
would you
then, Mr. Lampkin, the anticipation? Then is that the Department of Commerce would later come back to regulations and define what that endorsement would be. Because it currently doesn't exist. So at this moment, someone has a Department of Tobacco endorsement and they have a point that you don't want to say you need a tobacco endorsement for this, but you're saying you want to have some type of endorsement and you're anticipating the Department of Commerce would come back and do regulation to define what that is.
Correct.
It's suddenly kind of similar. I think what we're wondering is why replace tobacco there with business license and instead not simply add e-cigarette, comma, buy tobacco and endorsement as opposed to business license? Are we inadvertently, I guess, opening up running the underlying tobacco statute there? By changing the business license versus the tobacco
industry. Thank you for that question. First of all, it's a legal drafting choice. They just purpose behind the intent there is because we have two separate products here. We've got the tobacco products and we've got the ESPs, and they're trying to put them in a little bit both.
Okay.
If you're going to sell either one of them, you have to have this endorsement. And for that, then I also want to pass the fiscal note that. If we don't want to separate them because otherwise we're going to make folks that are currently selling tobacco products if they also want to sell these cigarettes and have to not get a second endorsement, this will kind of merge the two.
Okay.
If you already have a tobacco endorsement, you will automatically have the ESP endorsement.
Thank you.
And then 043 cereal serving fire is that license. And under LA, if you look at Section 8, if you use that license today, all it does is add electronic smoking products or products containing nicotine to that definition, but it's next to existing law.
Thank you.
Okay, Section 8. So that is conformity that limits existing law really on the sort of tobacco awareness by having the same penalty provisions and putting quite a bit of fines for some of these cigarette ESPs or nicotine products to manage.
For example, there's a law requiring signage. Currently, as you may have seen, many of the stores, there's a sign on the internet selling tobacco products to minor ages 18 is illegal. This would also require, marijuana that states there, but the sale of products, 24 hours apart, to any 18 year person would be illegal. And also, as we are assisting out, as you may know, there's the department is required to provide the signage on request by the vendor. And they have currently set up a DFD review, so when those requests are made, they just simply email the vendor that signage and the vendor can print it off on their own. So there should be virtually zero fiscal impact to the state, at least in terms of producing a DS for that sign that the respective vendors should print off. Position 11 has existing enforcement provisions.
Yes.
I would have to defer to the department on that one. I think it's specifically for kids that may be addicted to nicotine, and that they need a local means to help them with. This is, I think, the real core insight behind that section of the statute.
Actually, the prescription now, if you look on page 3 and line 4, the existing prescription is for a smoking cessation or harm reduction product. And that they've added an exception where that might be the case for this PSA product as well.
Is that
one back? Yes. He knows this one.
Okay, it's section 11. Existing enforcement provisions that allow the Division of Behavioral Health to allow them to enforce these statutes, essentially to go ahead and seize products, seize and assist in sales of these products and so forth. Just as if they were selling a cigarette or tobacco product, the state would have the same authority to enforce violations of the selling of those pieces. Section 12 is that if you're performing as a direct sale to allow one business facility, then there might have multiple locations that they sell these tobacco products, and they just have the requirement to purchase and secure one business license endorsement, and that applies and applies for all of their locations. And so, similarly, it would also apply to all their ESP products if they're selling in multiple locations. Section 13 through 18 are all amended for conformity that has been tobacco sales to allow the initiatory hearing the administrative process if there is a violation and involves to be disputed or appealed by the vendor that doesn't include the DA. Section 19 also added for consistency linking the definition of the ESPs and distinguishing them from tobacco or traditional cigarette. Products and other modern nicotine alternatives. Section 20 is also a conformity as in tobacco products, and the vendor must have the appropriate license endorsement to allow for selling cigarettes on nicotine products. And Section 21 is also a successful provision. Section 21 is the Division of Behavioral Health ability to enforce. I'm sorry, Section 12, I misspoke. Section 12 is regarding the vending machine. And then, of course, Section 22 is the effective date of applicability.
Questions for the sponsor or the defendant?
Let's start with Section 4 at page 3, line 4. That smoking cessation product is a product that is expected to be consumed without being combusted. So pretty purely smoking cessation, right? I'm sorry, Chief Kennedy here. What did you say? Hold on for page 3, page 3.
9-4, where it talks about those exemptions, if you will. It did not apply to the sale of sand or dirt to a person under 18 years of age. Here we go to that 9-4. But 9-4 through 19 is about purely smoking cessation products that are not combustible. So, it might take forever to be like a month or four to draft for three. The note that on page 2, page 21 to 31, page 3, line 3, is identical to that subsection on page 3, line 4 through line 19. Okay? So, one, the first part of it is focusing just on the SDs. The second section is focused on everything else that has an entity, self, cigars, on the other side of the products. And that was a choice made by the drafter to separate those two things. They're identical otherwise. I don't understand I personally think beer covers would be a product containing nicotine or an electronic smoking product without the new section. Because essentially what you do in the new section is you open up the distribution of electronic smoking products. The distribution like that in almost all cases. It doesn't seem like there's a qualifier for that. Okay. Mr. Dalton said something like all of that, and be sure to report that.
What was the subject of marijuana dealt with, or is it not dealt with in this particular
legislation? Madam Chair, we're not touching that at all in this legislation, but I will note for you that some of these products, they are chemical components in their own human DNA, but some of them are odorless, or tasteless, but there's no smoke or mist or vapor at all. You cannot detect them. And it's my understanding that that includes products not only of flavor juices or nicotine packs, but also could include THC capsules. For information, but that doesn't necessarily apply directly to this bill. No, but the use of possession of these components, these mechanical pieces, may be in violation. But if that capsule is inside that pen, where you say rather pipe or whatever. If it's THC or it's nicotine, that's gonna be treated differently. I can't speak to it down that.
Because of the First Amendment issues and so probably come to the regulatory process from the board then. Okay, any further questions on the bill itself? Okay, thank you both. Because there's some custom in this community, I'm also going to say it's not a credit card. And so I will allow members to think over and work with you and some of the questions they have. Any final parting words for some of our students? Okay, thank you for your time. I'll go ahead and go to the folks that are online right now. And it's my attempt at 2:30 to go ahead and set the bill aside. Bring up 174. For a motion and then take the initial testimony on Senate Bill 103 is not submitted and bring it to the queue. So we'll go ahead and just go down in order of those that have joined and know the time that they're joined. So I'm going to go first to the next one, I'm going to ask Ashley Stroll and Octavia Harris. Ashley, are you here? If you put yourself on the record, please. Any affiliation you choose to give and offer your testimony?
Thank you for having me. My name is Ashley Stroll, and I'm a citizen of the Serving Community. And I'm very concerned about your cigarette sales and usage, especially among our youth. We know that about 18% of youth in Alaska are currently using e-cigarettes. And as you know, e-cigarettes are 3,000 chemicals in them. There are 7,000 chemicals in traditional cigarettes. 69 of those cause cancer, and we do have a lot of those same chemicals in electronic cigarettes. We also have nicotine in electronic cigarettes and we do in traditional cigarettes. But a lot of times, nicotine is in alcohol,
Said something you agreed before, you can also say goodbye. I appreciate the brevity we're putting on the record, the door of the meeting, you should testify. Next, we have Steve Mates, who is this not our school?
Being considered by the officials who are writing bills.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. I know you're aware that the bill before us only does deal with youth, but I understand you're speaking of other bills out there. The member go to Wasilla, Ashley Pelletier. Evening, Ashley.
Yes, I'm here. My name is Ashley Pelletier. I live in Bolton, Wasilla, and I would echo the sentiments of Fulton Fairbanks in support of this bill. I am a little confused as to the language in Section 4 and the provision, especially the one that references e-cigarettes being prescribed by a healthcare professional and being given to a person by their parent or legal guardian. I would like to remind you that e-cigarettes and vaping products are not FDA approved, and they are not an FDA approved prescription device. There is no proof that they help people quit smoking. In fact, we know that there are people that have used their traditional cigarettes at the same time to become new users. I would add that these FDA approved cessation medications are not approved for use by youth or anyone under 18. So this section is very confusing to me. I don't see how anybody would give it to somebody under the age of 18, given that it's not FDA approved. But other than that, I am in support of this bill, and thank you for doing whatever we can to keep these devices out of the hands of our youth.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to, let's see here. Angela, if you're open, Lucilla, if you're here.
I'm here. If I can't remember the members of the support of the State Judiciary Committee, I am in the chair of the Lucilla. I'm speaking on behalf of the members of the Super Trail Alternative Trade Association. The Super Trail Alternative Trade Association has a full agreement with state restrictions on electronic delivery systems. And it's compelling, including e-liquids. However, we would like to request that public standalone enforcement for electronic nicotine delivery systems be enacted instead of tobacco enforcement. While we agree with all the agencies, we also understand there are comparable aspects of tobacco enforcement, such as businesses where the majority of the nation is not electronic delivery systems, such as all the some of these devices cost a lot of money. And
isoprene, nickel lead, nicotine, and the natural store nicotine. prison home for the doctors from the California Division of Health, which has put out within the last year in formal opposition to the UPEC threats by teenagers. So I would so strongly support the passage of Senate Bill 141 to protect the youth in the state from these toxic fumes, and also there's a higher risk once they start using these as cigarettes, if they have nicotine, they're going to become cigarette smokers in their adult life. So I would urge passage of Senate Bill 141. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. 80 seconds. Are you there, Anchorage?
I support Senate Bill 141 fully. The people who are under the age of 19 should not be legally allowed to purchase or own an electronic voting device or an automated card. These cigarettes, they can come in target and carrier projects, but they leave the candy flavor of Houston to get similar to how the tobacco companies did decades ago. It's not a risk-free product for anyone, especially youth. Everyone's not allowed to use one race here in Anchorage. It's really astonishing to see the number of young people using these products grow each year. If Missouri is going to sell the products, it's near going to support the health of a lot of these people.
Thank you very much, Amy. Amanda Leonard?
Hi, this is Amanda Leonard. I am a good resident, and I am here representing myself. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 141, including the legal purchase age of 19 and licensing shops to sell e-cigarettes and vapor products. There have been 11 ways I've been using e-cigarettes and vapor products to use among youth. It's important to decrease the accessibility to these products by measures to make sure they're not in the hands of those who are not legally able to use these products. If something that's nicotine at a young age can increase cigarette use among teens, we know that there's been a ton of work done. A lot of hard work done in the last decade to decrease the amount of the kind of youth that are using professional cigarettes in the last, and we want to make sure we're not doing that work that has been done. So I fully support passing Senate Bill 141. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the last person we have to testify is Emily Neen with the American Cancer Society. Welcome, Emily. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Emily Meehan, I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. A few things that I want to add, we'll be looking closely at some of the languages that were made in the current work draft, just to make sure all the pieces got picked up, that I'm very familiar with the proceedings intent with this legislation, which is to get some improvements over the legislation that was passed a few years ago, that Representative Steenhoek brought forth about not selling nicotine products to kids. As you've heard, the problem we face now is that the enforcement ability is not there. So just because it's illegal doesn't mean anybody can do anything about it. By including electronic cigarettes in the tobacco sales license enforcement piece, then when the State Health Department goes out and does their compliance checks, works with vendors to keep them from telling kids, they can have some ability to go back and enforce if these vendors are caught selling to kids and make sure that that education work is done there. We've had tremendous success in this state with our current structure of being able to get suspensions on those business licensing and personal for tobacco sales to youth. We've seen the compliance rates go way up, so we're starting on, we know we're starting on less tobacco kids as these works. How do you describe those rates for us? You have it correctly, Chair, and I'd love to hear, you know, from the beginning of your efforts 16, 20 years ago on cessation for children. Where are the youth smoking rates in Alaska?
Smoking rates, thanks to honestly, a lot of youth folks here and a lot of the work around the state. Alaska has been investing in tobacco prevention. We have seen, and this is just totally unprecedented, and it's hard to believe it's true, we're seeing 70% decline in youth smoking rates in the last 20 years.
So the last thing is actually being committed for the effort of the challenge that we have now with electronic cigarettes is we now have more youth using high school students using electronic cigarettes that are smoking. So we had our smoking youth smoking rates down to about 11%. We now have youth using electronic cigarettes at 18%. Just briefly, I know you're short on time, I want to preface a couple of things. Nationally, we're seeing youth that high school students who have never smoked, but reporting ever using e-cigarettes were using e-cigarettes at baseline were almost 2.7 times more likely to start using combustible tobacco after 1 year compared with high school students who had never used e-cigarettes. So what we're seeing is that youth transitioning from e-cigarettes to smoking. And that's a very concerning fact. There's one other quick point I want to make, everything else I can get to the committee in writing, and that is this issue about whether electronic cigarettes are regulated as tobacco products or something else. About 6 years ago now, back in 2010, there were some e-cigarette manufacturers who sued the FDA to be treated as tobacco products. When the FDA got federal ability through the Family Smoking Prevention Act, something I didn't but when the FDA was going to take over that regulation of tobacco products, the e-cigarette manufacturers went to court to say they had a choice. FDA was going to regulate them as a drug delivery device or a tobacco product. The FDA wanted to regulate them as a drug delivery device. They went to court and they won to be considered a tobacco product. So it's just something to keep in mind that is federal law for being regulated as tobacco products, and that was the industry that brought that measure forward. The health purposes would have actually preferred that they be regulated as drug delivery devices because the standards are much higher of regulation of drug delivery devices than of a tobacco product. That's important. Well, thank you. Thank you for your work. I think there are a few things in this building that everyone can agree on, seems like both sides of the aisle and those houses. I don't think we all agree on adult smoking or adult control of adult behaviors in general, but we're trying to think we all agree on this one. It's an extremely addictive substance, and if we can prevent kids from becoming addicted to nicotine or being potentially exposed to carcinogenics, then we want to, and I think you're fine working on it. Excellent. So we're going to go ahead and close our public testimony for today on Senate Bill 131. We'll go ahead and open it back up again when we take the bill back up. But we'll move now to Senate Bill 174. And that is chaired by Senator Kelly. And I believe his representative is here. We'll go ahead and take a brief phase and allow for a chance. We're back on the record with Senate Bill 174, and we do have a couple of folks online for questions for the members of the patient, Matt Cooper, who is the general counsel for the University of Alaska, and I hereby extend my Christina also with the general counsel's office for the University of Boston, they're available for questions only. And then Joanna Young is the only person I have remaining to testify there for being somebody else. So I'm going to go ahead and go to Ms. Young. If she puts herself on the record and tell us what your testimony is on Senate Bill 174, please. Senator Kiesel, there are some individuals parents and medical directors and so forth, you know, we can do that on the record at some point, either today or the next hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Gavin Beasley of the Minnesota District. Yes, Madam Chair, I will be brief so that the folks that are radio who can testify can speak today. The bill pertains to residential psychiatric treatment facilities and the education of the students that are housed in these facilities for treatment. So, a few years ago, I did a ride-along with a police officer. Well, the calls we received was a young man who was in foster care with a foster parent at a retail area store in Anchorage, and he was having a meltdown. The police officers helpfully took the young man down, and we put him in the police car, and he went with us to Northstar Hospital, where he was admitted. Now, of course, I didn't follow the young man's progress beyond that, but he may have been admitted for a week, a month, maybe even a year. And during that time, of course, he's away from his neighborhood school. Now, Madam Chair, you and I know as moms, so when kids miss school and they start to fall behind, they start to feel very stressed. And this can only add a behavioral health issue to the stress that can be felt. And if kids really fall behind, they may fall back even a year in school or more and lose hope of ever catching up. The purpose of this bill is to require local school districts to partner with the residential psychiatric treatment centers to provide ongoing education for the students. Right now, many school districts do partner well. In Phoenix, there's a contract that exists between the Boys and Girls treatment facility there with the school district. In other areas, it's lacking, and that's what the bill is meant to correct. It's a three-year pilot program, Madam Chair, that would require that kind of collaboration of lesson plans and teaching plans. In your packet, Madam Chair, you'll find a letter that opposes this bill. But it's the only letter that I'm aware of that we received that opposes it in Virginia Anchorage School District. I want to give you a backstory here. You see the date on that letter is March 7th, 2016. This bill was last heard in Senate Education Committee on March 1st. And at that kind of hearing, our colleague, Senator Gardner, at the end of the hearing, as we were about to move the bill out, shared with the committee that she had been trying for months to get the Anchorage School District to respond to her about this bill. She had written, she had called, and gotten no response, and she said, you know, I think I understand why the psychiatric treatment centers are having such a problem getting a response from the school district, because I, as a legislator, am having that same problem. They will not fit the letter of opposition or I don't care. So I just put that opposition in context. There are very specific elements that are included for a treatment facility to include in a lesson plan, and you'll find those on pages 3 and 4 of the bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I will conclude my part of this. Certainly, my staff can be very sectional if you'd like, or we can move to testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. I would like to know, Senator Beasley, thank you for bringing that forward. Two questions I have. The first is, in the dollars in the foundation formula, the bill was easily anticipated by the bill sponsor that the dollars would follow the student in the educational structure that will be created. Again, we don't necessarily know what it looks like in the SPIA program, but would it be anticipated that those dollars would follow the student into that environment?
Madam Chair, for the record, Carrie Morsaki, Senator Diesel. So that was how the bill was originally formatted prior to introducing this funding substitute. The way this version works is it will be the residential psychiatric treatment centers, or RPTCs, will contract with individual school districts to ensure, and they, within that contract, they would work out how that funding would be formulated. I believe in your packet there is a copy of the contract that Northstar Hospital put forward to the Anchorage School District that was rejected. Just for context of what a potential contract would look like, Madam Chair. This program also will allow the RPTCs to contract with more than one school district to ensure that
the borough can do an excellent cleaning with its schools. So, for example, as they see from Burbank's and up at North Shore Hospital in Anchorage, which is a good contract with the Burbank's North Shore Rural School District to ensure that the curriculum that Burbank's North Shore Rural School District students can ensure that the child stays on track.
Okay. Your point is, when you're doing these pilot programs, you're entering a territory and trying to make compromises. I can see where the school district might be feeling about that. You see another being removed, and this potentially becoming its own sort of charter school entity. On the other hand, it's the kind of thing I'm hoping we'll come back and report on the pilot program about how well those contracts fared and whether or not the behavioral health center was able to receive enough compensation to cover the program. I mean, what you want, of course, is the child to be educated, and so I assume they'll negotiate back and forth that something to look ahead at on the record when the pilot program is completed to be sure that the contract is allowing for enough compensation at the behavioral health center.
Madam Chair, the director of our staff is Senator Diesel. Donna also is in the room. She is the director of education services for North Star Hospital. I think she may be able to speak more to what the outlook is in the future for these contracting services, as well as the difficulties that they have faced trying to ensure that the services, educational services, are provided to the students in their facilities. And now we'll go ahead and thank you for that grant. My second question is just why for years? Why a pilot program versus changing law outright? And then why 3 years for the division?
Thank you, Chair Senator Diesel. That was a negotiation with the school districts and the division center. So we're happy to do it as a pilot program and demonstrate the success.
Okay, and that's good. I'm happy to respect those sponsors in Type 1. I recognize these are delicate things. I'm always weary myself. I've had a couple of bills that get relegated to pilot programs, and if you don't watch them carefully, people who oppose them to begin with can kind of sabotage the outcome. So I just say keep your eye on the ball there, and maybe you have an opportunity annually in whatever committee or summer you get sort of an update on that to bring it all out to the light of the day.
Any questions from members?
I really appreciate this, and I will probably look for any flexibility because I don't plan to share it with you on the podcast. But if you have sponsors, I apologize for that. I asked this before. You have several districts in Alaska that have students that have this need. I know that Fairbanks says, well, pretty cooperative in their district. Is that true in other areas of Alaska as well?
Senator, I'll go through the chair, Senator Diesel again. Certainly, we know Fairbanks has been very successful. As I already stated, Anchorage was the largest school district, has not seen that level of success. I'm not familiar with what other school districts have done, but we would like to make sure there's uniformity so that students are being educated.
I think the need is great, and like you say, the children's lives don't stop just because they're in a treatment center. So I think probably everything is that that value is probably asked them out and see how other districts are kind of over 30 for a unique need.
Excellent.
I have no questions. I was going to wait and ask the sponsor. So in your vision, this panel, if there's also a student who was in for ample needs and a fraction of that BSA for the year that would be applicable at the time of the likely, right? You would see that it being it's a little bit expensive. It would have some relation to the amount of time that they were actually in the facility.
So I'm getting to the chair, absolutely. A fraction of the time. It doesn't only the time that they were in the residential treatment. And of course, some kids are in for a very short period of time, but others, it can be months, just depending on their condition.
The thing that I really appreciate, Senator Diesel, that you link to the outside as mothers and fathers of children is the behavioral behavioral component, self-worth component of school attendance, and they need to continue that social connection. And even for 2 weeks, if a child is at school or comes back and is behind their peers, they're already suffering from other mental health issues. There can be teasing that goes on. They can be removed from other activities that, bond the group and continue them moving forward. So I really appreciate it, especially when you look at CIRs where we do have such a high rate of mental health issues when it comes to, and then of course the suicide that can come from that as well. So I appreciate the bill. Okay, with that, we will go to the folks that are in the room, and I'm going to respect the bill sponsors list here and go in first to Mike Lyons.
Thank you.
need to do is start questioning whether or not the school service is expected or actually being delivered at the tree. In closing, we would like to know record, as we have several times been acknowledging the progress made on behalf of the district. However, we know that there needs to be another option that's found within Fairfield 103 that would allow a more seamless care experiment and outcome-driven model. Thank you very much for your support of Fairfield 103.
Thank you, Mr.
Lyons.
A question from Senator Bill
McCuskey. Yeah, thank you. Would the employees that you hired, would the firms that you're receiving be employees of the school district or employees of your partner organization?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that question. Under this model proposed, the employees, the teachers would be employees of the facility. However, it would still not go through all of the same license requirements to the Department of Education.
Would they be entitled to the same health care benefits, retirement plans as English school district employees?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for that question. Employees that work for the facility have a compensation package through the facility. Therefore, their retirement benefits, and any other benefits would go through the facility.
Is your organization in the Anchor facility a non-profit organization or is it a for-profit organization?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Our facility located in Anchorage is set up as a for-profit organization.
Are you aware of any other for-profit organizations that receive funding to educate children in the civilian language or the same classes in America?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. We do not know of any other for-profit entity that receives public funds in such a matter. However, it is our practice across the nation that school district contracts with for-profit and not-for-profit organizations to provide educational services. They've come to that conclusion, recognizing that there are certain times, especially when it comes to children with pediatric needs, that perhaps the pediatric facility and the pediatric behavioral health provider is more equipped to handle those sets of behaviors associated with that population. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act also allows for school districts to provide contract with
I don't know what the Constitution is like in those other states, but in Alaska, our Constitution prohibits public money going for private education. And have you received any legal opinions on whether or not this would violate the Alaska Constitution?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Under existing Alaska statute, there is a contracting for services under AS 14-03-003, in which a school district may contract for educational services provided through the district. So therefore, we see that this would go under that provision and would be an allowable expense.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to clarify a couple things on that. One, we'll pull the nitrogen. Specifically, the Constitution prohibits public money for parochial for religious-based education, but not necessarily private, but we'll clarify that constitutional provision. Senator Jimmy?
Clarify the record for this bill is an occasion for the statute and not the Constitution. I have a question for Mr. Lyons as well.
Senator Jimmy, question for Mr. Lyons.
So, Mr. Lyons, what do you think the potential might be if this bill were to pass the various districts might realize that the state is serious in this effort and might be willing to work a little closer in delivering the adequate level of services and facilities?
Thank you, thank you very much for that question. Over the past 2 years, we have met numerous problems in the Anchorage School District. And there have been numerous times with the Commissioner of Education outlining exactly what the problems were, how they can be addressed, and actually identified a number of different solutions. really kept on getting overwhelmed. And sadly, none of those solutions were ever acted upon. It wasn't only until just this last year that the education debate on the subcommittee decided the issue that we actually started to get some traction. However, even after that subcommittee was set up to study the issue and toward the facility, there were still items that are popularly found at any school that were not being addressed by an active school district. So in order for this to really move forward, we believe that there needs to be another opportunity to serve these children.
Last year, we didn't
answer
the question, but I understand what you're saying. I appreciate that. My point is that this might be, I hate to use the word hammer, but I mean, for one, it is a certain motivation for the districts to take this a lot more seriously. And I understand what you've gone through for the last 6 years, and I see my own fabulous, but a bill like this that would pass maybe just enough to bring everybody to the table and satisfy the needs of those students who aren't getting that today. So, those who all give you a social line of Article 7, nobody should be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. So, it doesn't matter if it's private or private institution is educational or if they're providing education as an effort, I think that would come into question. Because what's the primary purpose in this institution? And I think that there's to be free from sectarian or religious control. I think that's the primary reason for that. But the private educational institution, that becomes a big question. Do you intend that any of the funds that you receive will go towards profit, or are you intending that 100% of funds go into the classroom?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. In the bill, between my time that will be measured and one of those is the full transparent budget of revenue and expenses, we would be spending 100% of the fund on educational resources.
You guys have helped come to figure out some backup for you. You don't need help with backup here. We're going to keep this on the record. Good afternoon, Julie McBarr. My name is Emily Lance. I am the Director of Education for North Shore University. I invited my colleague, my friend, platform this afternoon. I wanted to clarify just a couple of things. The first thing I wanted to clarify is that if you look closely at the standards that we have in the community substitute bill in front of you, you will see that we are open to an audit to our books. So that it's a yearly audit, so that we can take a very close look at how those funds are being spent. And those funds are only spent on the educational purposes for the children. Also, I would also like to clarify that we would not be perceived as an educational institution. We are perceived as a hospital or a residential treatment facility. Patients or students that are in our facility are placed there under a doctor's order, a physician's order. We are 24-hour nursing care.
Whether it's a for-profit or non-profit, I think it's really not the question. It's where does the money go?
Excellent. Okay, so at this point, sir, if you're right after, I'm wondering if there is anyone that is online or in the audience that cannot come back Wednesday for the continuation of the hearing on this. Is there anyone online? Make yourself known loudly. In great respect to those who have been waiting online, especially the parents, we're looking forward to hearing your testimony. We just had a big robust agenda today, and so we will get to you at the top of the hour on Wednesday. Okay? Anything could have been more? And with that, we're adjourned.